Welcome to this podcast of the July meeting of the IFRS Interpretations Committee. I'm Bob Garnett, Chair of the Committee, and I'm joined by Michael Stewart, Director of Implementation Activities.
Hello.
At this July meeting, we considered a number of items, including the finalisation of an interpretation dealing with accounting for stripping costs in the production phase of a surface mine, an interpretation that is linked to IS 16, although of course that standard excludes from its scope the extraction of mineral ores. Having finalized the interpretation from the committee's point of view, we now have to send it to the ISB for their formal approval by a majority vote to issue, so it has the full authoritative status of an IFRS. Because of the timing of the board meetings, that will only be considered at the September meeting of the ISB. In the meantime, we will publish during August the proposed final interpretation approved by the IFRS Interpretations Committee that will be available on the subscriber website so that you can see the detailed proposals and the basis of conclusions supporting those proposals. If we turn to other matters, though, on our agenda, work that we added in a previous meeting dealing with the levies that are imposed for a variety of reasons, whether on banks, on commercial companies such as railways, or even, as we learn, on pharmaceutical companies that are producing pharmaceutical products, other drugs, for use by state authorities. The questions here have really been around when should the liability be recognized, particularly when the conditions for establishing the liability are based on participation in a market or continuing to operate at a particular point of time. Some have looked at a former IFRIC interpretation, number 6, dealing with liabilities arising in the specific market of waste electrical and electronic equipment, and whether that can be used by analogy. The committee's discussions so far, though, have focused on an interpretation of IS 37, and also looking at the lessons we've learnt out of IFRIC 6 to see that we're being consistent. But Michael, we seem to have now got a range of different types of levy on which questions are being raised. At the May meeting, asked you and the staff to do some outreach to standard setters around the world to see what experience they had. And based on that, I think you found that there are now, although there are many different types, that they fall into some familiar patterns.
That's right. And one of the key features that we find that is giving rise to some degree of difficulty or challenge in terms of working out what the accounting should be is where we have two time periods involved. Time period, which is the period during which a particular financial measure, such as revenue, arises that is used in the calculation of the amount of the levy that is to be paid. And we've taken to calling this the calculation period. And then the second period that's involved is what we've been calling the activity period, which is when a further activity needs to take place by the company in order to trigger the levy and trigger the liability. And it's the interaction between these two periods and the different activities that take place in those two periods that raises the question as to, well, which one of these is the one that should be resulting in the recognition of a liability? And so that's what we're now focusing on to work out which of those two is the one that should dominate the timing of recognition of the liability, or is it some sort of combination of the two? an interaction of the two. And as you said, that's the key issue that we're looking at as to when to recognise the liability. And a related issue is to do with interim reporting. And so whilst we're going to be focusing principally on the general issue about timing, we're hoping that through doing that, the secondary issue of when to recognise the liability and the expense in interim financial reports will become apparent from the work that we do on the primary issue.
All right. It's obviously something that is topical in certain industries at the moment, and people are becoming a little concerned as to whether or not, with the high degree, shall we say, of certainty that governments are going to impose these levies, but without telling us the details of how they're going to collect it necessarily, or even, in fact, if they'll still be in power in order to vote it through Parliament, that sometimes we just have to wait until the legislation has been enacted before we can be definitive. But it sounds as if this is something that is going to be an enduring issue, and the work that the committee does on this, therefore, will provide benefit for many years to come.
Indeed, and it's by focusing on these key features that I hope will result in some degree of general guidance that can be used on a number of different levies, rather than just focusing on a select number of specific levies from specific countries.
Turning to some of the new issues, the issues that were discussed for the first time in the July committee meeting, again, there seems to be some commonality, if I can use that term, between the types of requests, all involving business combinations, some of them really questioning whether a business combination needs to have something more than the apparent combination of two businesses, and also what to do in circumstances where a business combination is set up or arranged so that it's what we call under common control, both before the business combination and subsequently. Doesn't seem to be an issue that's only restricted to the outright combination of businesses, but we've also had questions surrounding joint ventures and whether or not the bringing together of or even the acquisition of an interest in one of those joint ventures in fact constitutes a business combination as the basis for the accounting. It's a little surprising that all these questions have suddenly popped up so soon after the board has published. Of course, it's new IFRS 10 on consolidations and 11 on joint arrangements, but perhaps that has sparked some renewed interest. How are you going to deal with all of these different issues coming through to us now then, Michael?
Well, some of the ones to do with sort of reorganizations of groups and some of the common control business combination type questions that we've got, those, I think, you know, do relate to the broader concerns that some people have over accounting for business combinations between entities under common control. And that, given the breadth of that issue, I think that is something that really that we need to look to the board and ask for the board to take that on to their agenda. And obviously, the board are consulting shortly on their agenda. But in terms of some of the narrower related issues, I think there may be something that we can do on that. But first, we need to do a bit more research. There were a couple of issues in particular. One was to do with, as you mentioned, the purchasing of an interest in a particular type of joint arrangement. So a joint operation where parties to the joint arrangement, say, have a much closer relationship with the operation itself. And the question there was whether if you were to acquire an interest in a joint operation that conducted a business, whether in fact you should be applying business combination type accounting to account for your interest in that. So if there, I think the key consequences there would be, from an accounting perspective, is, well, what do you do with your transaction costs associated with purchasing your interest? And then follow-on questions to do with deferred tax and goodwill arise as well. So we're going to be looking at that to see if we can give more clarity to that that issue and see if there is a possibility of addressing that through annual improvements. The other question that we had on a related topic was purchasing an interest in an investment property. And where does the line fall between purchasing just an asset or a group of assets versus purchasing a business? And if we think about what a business is, well, a business is an integrated set of activities and assets that is capable of being conducted and managed for the purpose of providing a return. And we often think of it in terms of these inputs, processes, and outputs. The outputs generally being in the form of revenue being generated or other economic benefits being produced. The key challenge I think that we're looking at in this particular issue is what we mean by processes and what does it take in terms of the provision of services in the context of an investment property to trigger the presence of processes being acquired and therefore would lead to the conclusion that there's an investment, that there's a business present. So we're going to do some more research on that to see if we can maybe develop some guidance to help draw the line between the two. We were looking at it in the context of investment properties, but there is a broader issue there that I think may well be helped by whatever research and proposals we might be able to bring to the committee in respect to this issue.
So I suppose we could characterize this another way by saying that by focusing on the principles, we would expect to get the same accounting, but because there is a difference in the way that groups of assets are accounted for, essentially on a cost accumulation basis, and the way that a business is accounted for, which is an allocation of the purchase price across the fair value of the assets and the liabilities, which could give rise to goodwill, that there are actually two different, shall we say, mechanical ways of arriving at the answer. Investment properties, though, I think would probably help us a little bit because investment properties typically are going to be valued at their fair value on a continuing basis with the changes through profit and loss. And because of the board's recently published IFRS on fair value measurement guidance, number 13, the unlucky one, then I suppose people wouldn't have any difficulty in knowing what fair value was to apply that, and any costs that were accumulated in the form of transaction costs the day after the acquisition had taken place, if the fair value was determined then those costs wouldn't be part of that fair value and would end up as a debit in profit and loss anyway. But we haven't made that decision yet, so let's have a look at the research you bring back the next time. Michael, the final issue I want to touch on is one that came through to us, and even though our submissions are normally done on an anonymous basis, it became obvious in the public meeting that one of our official observers representing the European Markets and Securities Associations was interested, in fact, in the application or the misapplication, perhaps, of IFRS 8 in dealing with two aspects. One, the aggregation of the segments, and the other, the identification of what we call the chief operating decision maker. Could you perhaps give us a little insight into this problem?
Yes, of course. The first of those two issues you mentioned is the aggregation of segments, and IFRS 8 allows us to aggregate operating segments into what we call reportable segments, but only provide certain criteria are met. And certainly the concerns that were brought to our attention by the submitter was that there may be circumstances where the criteria are not met and yet these segments are being aggregated. And so a proposal had been suggested in the submission for some increased disclosure to help really sort of identify or increase the chance of detection of when there may be inappropriate aggregation of those segments. Now, the committee's view on that when they discussed it was they felt, well, no, that wouldn't be an appropriate way to address this issue, and really we should be including disclosures in the standards that enable us to meet the objectives of the standards, and they felt that the disclosures we already have in IFRS 8 do help us to meet the required objectives there. But the other one was one which I think is one that will feature probably in the forthcoming post-implementation review. It's the issue about identifying the chief operating decision maker. Now, the standard describes really there are two aspects to the role of the CODM, as we call them. One is to do with the allocation of resources, and the other is to do with assessing performance. And sometimes, and we certainly hear about this, that sometimes those two roles are conducted by multiple persons. And so clearly, you know, even though they may be done by different people within the organization, they all form part of this overall CODM, Chief Operating Decision Maker role. And really, it's the whole of that function that should go into the identification of segments and, along with that, the identification of the information that needs to be disclosed as part of the segment reporting. And the other aspect that came clear through the discussions that the committee was having was that there are some who perhaps have taken it the chief operating decision maker to be the whole of the board of directors of a company. And yet, really, because we're talking about allocation of resources and assessing performance, really those are roles that are done by executive management rather than non-executives. And so perhaps there is a clarification that could be made that really we don't expect non-executives to form part of the CODM. So it wouldn't necessarily be the whole of a board of directors, but perhaps a subset of that board being executive directors, and perhaps adding in with them certain key senior management as well. So anyway, as I mentioned, the next steps on that, really, that the committee felt was, because it's quite a broad issue, really ought to be part of the post-implementation review of IFRS 8, which will be starting later this year. So we'll be making sure that the team working on that have that as one of the issues that they look at.
Right. So it sounds actually as if some people have forgotten that the purpose of issuing this was to assist in giving the management's view. We used the phrase before that segment reporting was through the eyes of management, and management are normally the people that have all the detailed work to do. So I guess an example of a group of management that you were talking about would be the same as the German Management Board. So not just outside directors. And certainly, if you've got a lot of independent non-executive directors on the board, then you wouldn't expect that they were the ones making operating decisions. Clearly, that would be contradictory. Well, we will await with some interest on the board's reaction to that. Just to finalise now, I need to remind everybody, of course, that the views that Michael and I have been expressing are our personal views, that the views of the committee and indeed of any formal interpretation are only obtained after full and open due process. So take that health warning as it comes. In the IFRIC update, which will be published shortly after the meeting, you can expect to see a table that summarizes the activity of the committee over the past 2 or 3 years, and to give an indication of the activity that we've endured, as it were, up until now. Bearing in mind that in 2010, the committee took on the work of annual improvements for the first time, but because of the ISB's current very full agenda, that there has to date been no reconsideration of annual improvements comments, as the ED has only just gone out for comments. So please get your comments in early so that it gives the committee something to talk about at future meetings. The next meeting that we will have will be on the 8th and 9th of September. Thank you for tuning in.